Please be seated. The second case for oral argument this morning is Carlos Covado, appellant versus the state of South Dakota, appellee. For the appellant, we have Mr. Paul Eisenbron, an attorney from Rapid City. For the appellee, we have Ms. Ann Meyer, an assistant attorney general from Pierre. I would like to welcome the students from Vermillion High School and hope you find this educational. With that, Mr. Eisenbron, you may proceed, sir, and you have 20 minutes.
There's no two ways about this. This is a very, very sad case. And this story starts with a little boy with a very troubled life. Carlos Covado is the son of Alicia Covado, who is not a stranger to this court, as well as the son of Chris Yellow Eagle, who is also likewise not a stranger to the court system. Carlos knew drug use from a very early age. He saw his father in and out of federal and state prison, beginning at a very early age. And he had all the trappings that come with that upbringing. In fact, in State versus Alicia Covado, you get a little bit of insight into what Carlos's life was like when the Unified Narcotics Enforcement Team burst in to the what you would call the family home at that point, and made arrests of both of his parents.
He wasn't named, but that was Carlos that opened the door.
That was Carlos in the door. I represented Chris Yellow Eagle as a defendant in that matter. From there, you fast forward several years, and Carlos obtains the privilege of attending high school out of state, away from some of his familiar problems, I guess you would say. And he does reasonably well at a Riverside High School in Oklahoma. Upon returning to South Dakota, Carlos, not knowing any other life maybe, having had been around drugs his entire life, seeks out the same habits he saw his parents do. And so he goes out with friends, and immediately they're buying alcohol. They're not old enough to buy alcohol. They're buying cold medicine that if you abuse, you can get high. And they go on quite a spree all night long, drinking, getting high, drinking, and getting high. From there, they decide they need a little bit more. They need a little more alcohol. And the group of boys walks into a convenience store on Mount Rushmore Road in Rapid City. And they decide they're going to steal a case of beer. And for reasons unknown to anyone, as they go out, the shop attendant attempts to apprehend the boys to stop the theft. And for her efforts, she receives about 7 stab wounds for that. It gets uglier still because the boys now very free to take their alcohol that they've stolen. For whatever reason, don't stop. Carlos comes back and gives the store attendant, Casey Lord, approximately 31 more stab wounds. As I said, the facts really in this case, it starts out sad and it ends sad. But that leads us into where this criminal case ended, which is sentencing. And in particular, we're talking about Eighth Amendment history here. Eighth Amendment history changes quite a bit, especially in the last 30 to 40 years. But even 100 years ago, the proposition that punishment should fit the crime was well established in Weems versus the United States. Over the course of history, over the last 120 years, 110 years, we've seen a shift away from punishment should fit the crime to a little more focus on the punishment should fit the crime and the offender. And so to set up my argument, I'd like to go through a little bit of that history. To give it some context. In 1989, the United States Supreme Court in Stanford versus Kentucky was faced with the question of whether or not we can execute, whether or not it is good, moral, and permissible under the Eighth Amendment to execute a juvenile under the age of 18, but at least over the age of 16. And the United States Supreme Court, in a divided court, came back and said, yes, in the United States in 1989, we will permit the execution of a 16 or 17-year-old offender. In 2005, in Roper v. Simmons, the court was asked to reconsider that question. In that case, there was a 17-year-old high school junior, Mr. Simmons, met with a couple of friends, set out to complete a burglary, and the facts seemed to indicate as well planned a murder at the same time. They walked into a woman's home, abducted her, tied her up, wrapped duct tape around her, and threw her into the river. He was convicted at trial and was sentenced to death. The state Supreme Court, in the intervening 15 years, changed its tune. They said, no, we're no longer going to execute juveniles under the age of 18. It's not something that our policy is going to tolerate, and we don't believe the Eighth Amendment tolerates that. Moving forward just a few more years, we get Graham versus Florida. In this case, we have a 16-year-old who pleaded guilty to a non-homicide crime, pretty serious felonies, robbery, but a non-homicide. Initially, he was sentenced to two concurrent terms of probation for 3 years, which was quickly violated, and the judge immediately handed out a life sentence in that case. So the United States Supreme Court was asked, shall we just be handing out life sentences for non-homicide crimes? And they said no. The penological goals don't apply the same for homicide crimes, especially when we're talking about juveniles. More to the heart of things, in 2012, the United States Supreme Court considered Miller versus Alabama. This is a pair of companion cases that were consolidated, asking whether or not we can have mandatory life sentences for juvenile offenders, whether it's homicide or not. And in both cases, both of the companion cases, there was a killing. Slightly different circumstances behind those, but in one of it was a pretty grisly killing.
So these are what are known as categorical restrictions on a sentencing court's authority to impose sentences on juvenile offenders, right?
Yes.
Roper, Graham, Miller.
Yes.
Our own cases. You have two arguments for us to consider here today. One, that this sentence violates one of those categorical restrictions. Two, that even if that's not the case, it is on its fact disproportionate to the gravity and the harshness.
Yes.
That are implicated here. First issue, why does this sentence violate a categorical restriction, and which one among those cases does it violate?
When you view Miller through Iowa versus Null, I think we're getting into a new realm that says basically lengthy, and just so we're clear, in the state's response brief, they wrote the defendant is attempting to expand Miller, and that's absolutely true. In the context of Null and Bear Cloud. This is a categorical sentence. The reading between the lines and using a bit of a crystal ball, it would appear that courts that follow this line of reasoning sort of expect that a juvenile defendant, be parolable roughly by about age 50. No one's written that. That's just looking at the kinds of sentences and kind of suggestions I'm seeing in these courts.
Well, clearly we're going to have to draw a line somewhere if we buy your argument.
Absolutely.
Where does that line get drawn?
Your Honor, I think it's approximately right where Mr. Quevedo's defense counsel asked for a 40 to 45 year sentence, which would make him parolable after 20 to 25 years.
And what authority do you cite for that?
Miller, Graham, Iowa versus Null, and Wyoming versus Bear Cloud.
And you're going just under the Eighth Amendment, just under the federal constitution?
Yes, yes. Though I must admit, Null was decided independently under the Iowa constitution.
Right.
Bear Cloud kind of brings that back together and conflates them. I'm sorry, Justice, what was your question again?
You answered it.
Okay.
So right now, as things stand, though, there's Miller leads off its categorical restriction at the point of a mandatory life sentence, one that, in other words, would deprive a sentencing court of the discretion that it otherwise would conduct or use to conduct a sentencing, except in a case like this, of course, for second-degree murder. Ordinarily, that would be an automatic life sentence. Miller says that can't be the case. And in fact, our legislature has acknowledged that in at least two statutes post-Miller. So you acknowledge, candidly, it seems like we would have to expand our version or our interpretation of Miller for you to win.
Yes, yes. I think that's absolutely true. And the reason for that is the shift in case law. Not only has Eighth Amendment case law shifted from the punishment should fit the crime to the punishment should fit the crime and the offender, there's also been a shift in the emphasis of the case law to the clause meaningful opportunity for release for a juvenile.
Mr. Eisenbrun, doesn't your argument or your suggested approach here ignore the fact that there is a huge disparity in the actual facts that may be involved in any particular juvenile case? And why should there be a hard and fast line drawn, or even something close to a hard and fast line, when those facts can be so different from one case to another in terms of the gravity of the offense in particular?
Thank you, Justice. And I think the answer to that is that lengthy terms of years, by their nature, are a hard, fast line. They deny the opportunity, or they tend to ignore the opportunity that a juvenile has for reform, their unique ability to change character and not be stuck in the criminal lifestyle.
But a juvenile wouldn't be without an argument. The juvenile could, even if he or she were precluded and didn't have the benefit of a categorical restriction, they could, as you've done in this case, make a separate argument that under the Eighth Amendment, for this case, there's disproportionality. That analysis, it seems to me, could contemplate the individual facts and circumstances, not only of the crime, but of the defendant. Is that not satisfying?
I appreciate your question, Justice. And that is, frankly, I believe one of the problems is with this whole land analysis with Noel and Bearcloud, is that these two, what were formerly completely separate forms of analysis, seem to be coming together. The proportionality does become a greater issue when we're dealing with an aggregate sentence or an otherwise lengthy term of years in any event. The application of all this argument comes down to this. This court should send this back for resentencing, and there's a number of reasons for that. While the circuit court did consider Miller, there's no way around that. Miller comes up in that sentencing transcript repeatedly. Judge Lindgren spent an awful lot of time, I think 8 hours that day, taking testimony, taking cross-examination questions, and considering it very carefully herself. But she didn't have the opportunity to consider this under the auspices of Null and Bearcloud. Those cases make clear, though they are simply persuasive authority, that the meaningful opportunity for release is a very, very important consideration, and it wasn't emphasized in that sentencing hearing. Bearcloud is very factually similar to Mr. Quevedo's case. In terms of the underlying sentence structure, it's 45 years, gonna have, once he parole, two parole eligibility. They would both be released under their sentences at about the same time. Bearcloud would be 61, Mr. Quevedo would be 62 upon his release under his current sentence. As well, Bearcloud had the benefit of a Miller hearing, I guess we would call it. And yet the Wyoming Supreme Court saw fit to adopt Null and send it back for further consideration.
In your principal brief, and I don't think in the reply either, you did not cite section 2261.3. Of course, that's the statute that says that a penalty of life imprisonment can't be imposed upon anyone under the age of 18. And so that seems to contemplate homicide, non-homicide, just statutorily. That restriction exists. The state mentioned it in passing. Not prison, just curious. Why didn't you cite it?
I guess hindsight's 2020, Justice. That does, I guess, provide further ammunition that legislatively we are moving in the general direction, if not specific direction, of a more lenient sentencing structure for juveniles.
But the legislature has the ability to do that, to craft more stringent sentencing parameters for juveniles. But that's not our issue here, correct?
Correct.
And right now we're dealing with, did the court properly weigh the Miller factors? Did the court properly consider everything that needs to be considered under the unique factors of this case in the Eighth Amendment analysis? You're indicating you don't believe the court gave sufficient consideration to some of the other cases that seem to be moving in the direction that you're urging us to move, correct?
That's correct, Justice.
But if we take that approach, how does that then affect other very recent opinions this court has already issued with very similar sentences rendered? The Charles case, for example, which was very, very close to what happened here.
As well as Diaz, I believe, is very similar, a little shorter sentence, but not a whole lot. I agree that those cases, those defendants, those convicts would be in a position where they'd be wanting to look at moving their circuit court for a new sentencing hearing at the very least. Regarding lengthy terms of years for juveniles, moving away from the categorical approach, one of the problems that we've got in these cases is that none of the penological goals apply to juveniles in the same way that they would apply to adult offenders. The penological goals being retribution, deterrence, incapacitation, and then, of course, rehabilitation. Viewing those goals through Miller and the meaningful opportunity for release kind of clarifies the position of defense here on proportionality. First, retribution. The United States Supreme Court said that the heart of the retribution rationale is that the sentence be directly related to personal culpability. Now, that's important in the juvenile context because while being a juvenile does not affect guilt, it certainly affects culpability, and Eighth Amendment case law is very clear on that point. Seeking retribution from someone less culpable just doesn't make sense. It's really not a goal that that the Eighth Circuit or that the Eighth Amendment seeks.
In this case, you mentioned it earlier. In this case, would you acknowledge it seems that the trial court, the sentencing court, had an appreciation at least for Miller, understood was implicated. Mm-hmm. Would you agree with that?
Yes.
The trial court also considered what you might call one of the more traditional sentencing factors, sort of what you're talking about, some of these, as I say, more traditional factors. One of them she mentioned was, it seems to me, I don't know that she said it exactly this way, but public safety, the idea that someone who's committed a murder like this under the influence is a risk to the public. Just curious, is that permissible in some degree for the trial court to still consider, or can they not consider it at all? Or do they consider it, but just it doesn't predominate over sort of the characteristics of youth and those mitigating effects?
Yes, and I think I would—
2 minutes, counsel.
Thank you.
Yep.
I think I would class that under the third goal, incapacitation. I think that is maybe the, aside from rehabilitation, the second most important possibility.
Still permissible under Miller.
Still permissible under Miller.
She specifically expressed her concern that the defendant could, in fact, if intoxicated, kill again. And so that's certainly an important penological objective for her consideration.
I agree. And I think under Miller, where they're talking about the rare, truly incorrigible juvenile, that incapacitation becomes a very important penological goal. But without consideration of meaningful opportunity for release and a finding of whether or not this person is that truly incorrigible child, Judge Lindgren left it in the air. We don't know. And I think that is the heart of all of these arguments, is that with juveniles, we don't know. And so I believe that's the great concern in the middle of it. I'll leave you all with that.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Eisenbrun. Ms. Meyer, you have 20 minutes.
May it please the court and counsel. Time after time, this court has said
that a term of years sentence is not a die-in-prison sentence. You've said it in Charles. You've said it in Diaz. Those cases are solid. The Supreme Court has, United States Supreme Court has denied cert. Different states do different things. We've referred to the split in our brief. And I have to point out, with Bear Cloud is completely different. There is a statute that the Wyoming legislature enacted which said that juvenile killers are eligible for parole after 25 years. We don't have a statute like that here. Iowa also is on the cutting edge of taking a different approach. But where we stand has been validated by the United States Supreme Court. And as far as...
Validated by the denial of cert?
I think so, yes.
That's not really a determination on the merits, though, is it?
It's not on the merits, but they're not taking many certs, so...
Well, in any event, those they never decisions- do. But in event, it seems that the legislature has done something after Miller.
They did. In South Dakota, that's true. You cannot get a life sentence if you are a juvenile. The longest sentence that you can get and you commit a crime would be life, would be a term of years or a fine, the $50,000 fine. So we have done something, yes. Everyone responded, as far as the state jurisdiction, to Miller in some way. Just different places have taken different approaches. And I wanted to get back to the fact that Judge Lindgren here did a very careful and comprehensive analysis. What Miller requires is that you look at these six factors that our court set forth in Charles, and she did that in a very, very conscientious way. And this defendant had every opportunity to present testimony. He called in an expert. The expert says he has a normal intelligence. He has no systemic psychological diseases. He was capable of making a reasoned decision. And he was a very logical kid. He had a lot of responsibility for his age, even though his family was dysfunctional. Very often, he was the only child who was taking care of things while his parents were under the influence of methamphetamine. And another one of the factors that the court looked at was, of course, his family life. As the defense counsel has referred to, his family life was dysfunctional. His parents were on drugs. He had to grow up faster than most kids.
What are some strong mitigating factors? Did the court adequately consider those in your view?
She did. She was very, very careful to consider all of them. She said, I met my duty under Miller. I met my obligation. She went on to say, I am also considering the defense's request for leniency and mercy. And the fact that the defendant took credit for what he'd done, he pled guilty. He said that I have no doubt, this is in quotes at the plea hearing, that he was the one who killed Cassie Lord.
What would you point to if we were in the sentencing transcript, if we were looking for an indication that the sentencing court considered the factor of rehabilitation?
The fact of rehabilitation? She listened to the defense's expert talk about how she couldn't be sure that this defendant wouldn't kill again. There's something more than just the combination of drugs that he took, and it's called robo-tripping, by the way, and that's on page 3 of the psychologist report. And you don't want to engage in this because it can cause coma and brain damage. But what she said was there's something more going on here that's reflected in the psychological report. The court picked up on that, and she said, "I nobody's clairvoyant. I can't be sure what's going to happen." But she still gave him a chance to reform. He has a light at the end of the tunnel, the glimmer of hope that's mentioned in Springer at 62. Now it's up to him. He's got an incentive to reform.
So the sentence itself is kind of self-evident proof or an indication that she considered rehabilitation because the parole eligibility is lower than his expected life expectancy?
That's what the state's arguing, yes. And that's what you see reflected in the case law as far as Charles and Dez and some of the other cases that the state cited from Nebraska and from Virginia. Those are the factors that the court looks, that reviewing courts look at. That's not to say that sometime before this court, you're not going to get a case where the sentence exceeds the juvenile's life expectancy. But this court has left that window open. They said in Charles, if that happens, then that may be something that we want to take a look at. But it's not this case, and certainly not the degree
of humiliation and harm and anguish that the victims suffered here with 38 stab wounds and bleeding out in the parking lot of the Come and Go.
Well, unless we extend Miller, which we haven't done, the way things stand right now is there's a categorical restriction for homicide offenders only on mandatory life sentences.
Mandatory, right.
Correct. Still, so why would we even talk about de facto sentences unless maybe we're talking about it under that statute? But
aggregate sentences come up all the time. There's always that possibility when somebody's killed more than one person or committed more than one crime. Juveniles can do that just as well as adults. That's still an open question. And
open
that's
how?
I'm sorry?
Open with whom?
We haven't decided aggregate sentences yet, nor has the United States Supreme Court. That's still a pending issue, just like how long does a term of years sentence have to be before it becomes a questionable situation under the Constitution? Thus far...
So do we follow Miller, or do we go charging into this open question area of whether a de facto sentence should trigger a categorical restriction?
The controlling precedent is Miller.
Yeah.
So we're following Miller. That's what this court has done in the past. And that's what the court did in this case. She was very, very careful, very conscientious to cover all of the factors that Miller requires. And she also was concerned about giving him a chance to reform. I don't think it's clear. The psychologist couldn't say for sure whether he would reoffend. He does have a long history of being involved with marijuana and alcohol. As a juvenile, he likes getting high. He likes mixing these cold medicines and everything. And he's got a chance now to try to show that he can be better than what he's been in the past.
Let me ask, since your opposing counsel is asking us to consider putting parameters on these types of sentences, do you think it is still... possible to make an Eighth Amendment, or is it appropriate to be able to argue an Eighth Amendment cruel and unusual punishment in a scenario where a term of years is given that is less than a person's life expectancy based upon the facts of the particular case, and it's a homicide case involving a juvenile?
I think you're restricted by Miller. I think that some courts have done that. They've gone on and beyond and said they want to give, for instance, we see there's more liberal courts than our state. There's Connecticut, California is going both ways. Iowa, there's always a chance that you could change your mind and go that way. But our position would be that the gold standard right now is Miller, and that's where our courts are looking to this court to find out what to do, and that's where this court has decided things in the past.
And maybe I asked it, let me ask it a little bit different posture here. Do you think there's anything about the current case law in South Dakota and the United States Supreme Court that would suggest the court shouldn't still engage in an Eighth Amendment analysis even when you have a term of years that is less than life expectancy?
That's an interesting question. The Eighth Amendment analysis, and I think the court addressed this in Charles, still survives. There hasn't been a case that says, you know, we throw that out the window. That was one of the arguments that the defense made in Charles. And it still survives. It still is what this court looks at. So, no, I think we're right where we should be. That would be our answer.
You're talking about the individual Eighth Amendment proportionality analysis, not the categorical restrictions under the...
Right. I'm talking about what factors you need to cover to make sure that we haven't violated this youngster's or young man's Eighth Amendment rights. I'm not going to go too far outside of what the defense has done. If the court doesn't have any further questions...
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Counsel. Okay, Mr. Eisenbrun, you have 10 minutes for rebuttal, sir.
Beginning in probably the 1980s, we had a big push all nationwide for, I guess, the law and order society. And I think the case law that we're looking at, the trends from the United States Supreme Court, as well as from Iowa and Wyoming, sort of recognize a little different principle. Not that law makes order, but that law can assist order. That if you have a fundamentally orderly society, as I believe we do here in South Dakota, that our laws and our rulings should reflect that underlying order. And so that's why we're asking that this court adopt an expanded view of Miller today. The United States Supreme Court has written that if none of the traditional penological goals are served by a particular type of sentence, then that type of sentence is going to be inherently disproportionate. And when we talked a little bit about the penological goals earlier, retribution just makes less sense in a juvenile context.
So go ahead, I'm sorry.
Are you suggesting that retribution should never be considered in the context of a juvenile case, particularly a homicide case?
No, not that it should never be considered.
Because it does seem to me that we're having this discussion focusing solely on the juvenile defendant. But isn't it true that our criminal justice system is not solely about the defendants in front of us, but it also is about the victims of violent crime? And shouldn't that also be a heavy factor that weighs into this whole consideration and whether or not they have received justice in that kind of ties a retribution goal?
Yes, Justice, I do believe that it is an important consideration. And of course, it's not off the table simply because we're dealing with a juvenile. Only that it is because of what the Supreme Court wrote, that the culpability ties directly to whether or not retribution is, I guess, how important retribution is. The United States Supreme Court has written, children are different. And so retribution, by that case law, is a reduced goal in a juvenile, considering a juvenile offender.
If we get to the point where we're considering the possibility of having a de facto sentence violate an Eighth Amendment categorical restriction, and we're examining this sentence under the standards that have been talked about, at least in Graham and other cases, this meaningful opportunity for release standard that you mentioned in your earlier remarks, Mr. Cavado is eligible at 62. The defendant in Charles, eligible at 60. We said that was not a de facto life sentence, or, I don't know, opined that that was not a de facto life sentence. This is 62, that's 60. We're talking about categorical restrictions, not individual defendants. Help me understand why you win that argument.
That comes down to the way that Knoll and Bearcloud were both decided. In both cases, there was a lot of epidemiological evidence submitted to the courts. There was an awful lot of sociological study submitted, and they decided to because, Justice, I think the point you implicitly make is a good one, I don't know what the difference between 60 and 62 is. I'll tell you in 30 years. But those courts rejected the pinpoint analysis of, you know, is 61 and 359 days enough, or is that too much? They avoided that and moved away and said, look, this is not meaningful. And that's why they focused on what meaningful opportunity for release is. They called a release in the 60s a geriatric release, and that was not good enough under their reading of Miller. The next typical penological goal is deterrence. The Supreme Court has written that the very nature, the very attributes that put juvenile offenders in their position also makes them less susceptible to deterrence. That goal is also less well served when you're dealing with the class of juvenile offenders. Moving on to incapacitation, which we talked about a little bit earlier, that is probably, in my view, the second most important goal when we're dealing with, when we have the finding of the truly incorrigible youthful offender, the ones that are not going to be fixed, the ones that are not going to be changed. Those folks are and should be eligible for very lengthy sentences. But that's not what we've got in this case. We certainly have no finding of that. The fourth, and I would submit the most important goal in these cases is rehabilitation. Rehabilitation for a juvenile offender is always everyone's hope, I think, but a very lengthy term of years flies in the face of rehabilitation. If we're going to put someone out at retirement age and then call them rehabilitated, it denies that meaningful opportunity for release. And so being as none of those goals are adequately served, a lengthy term of years is going to be inherently disproportionate in a case like this. With that, I'll leave you. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Eisenbrot. The court is finishing a little early on this. Council had their say and didn't use up all their time. We do also carry these arguments on the internet, and the next one is scheduled to begin at 11 o'clock. Even though we usually take a 10-minute break, it will be a little extended because we will commence the next oral argument at 11. So with that explanation, we are in recess till 11 o'clock.